Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 6th of January. We have great shows today coming up the first hour of the program. What does it mean to be a Democrat, and what does it mean to be a Republican? Our first guest, the first half hour, Howard Fineman, says in a recent piece, Obama's brand now is I'm a non-ideological, deal-doing, practical adult in a sea of extremes, and I will somehow get us on that sunny road. Now he's Barry the Cable Guy. He'll get her done. The Republicans, he says, don't have a cool logo as Obama did, you know, with the O and the going into the sunset. But their economic brand is Vivid, he writes. They're the folks who worship the market, or at least claim to. They always want to cut taxes. They pile up deficits while decrying them, and they favor pat-a-cake business regulation. Howard Fineman, senior political editor of the Huffington Post and author of the 13 American Arguments, Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country. He's also frequently on MSNBC, and he will be with us the first half hour. The second half hour, the senior editor of National Review, who's author of The Party of Death, The Democrats, the Media, the Courts, and the Disregard for Human Life, Ramesh Panuru, will be joining us. Hour number two of our program, Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, who's a very deep thinker and writes in his new book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future, that we need to remember our history, and we're not. So he'll be, well, he says a lot more than that, but he'll be with us the second hour of our program today. Both hours, you, of course, are welcome to call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Howard Fineman.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to do it.
So if we started reading the Constitution, would we be able to determine what the Democratic or Republican brand is from what we read today?
Good question. I don't think so. And I think, excuse me, both parties and everybody in America has an equal interest in and claim to the Constitution. The fact that the Republicans wanted to read it today, I see no objection to it.
Sure.
And I think we should all applaud, because it is our defining document, based on the book that I wrote and the studies that I did. We don't have a king. We don't have top-down power. We don't have a ruling religious elite. Our royalty, so to speak, is the Constitution. And when presidents take the oath of office, when other top officials take the oath of office, they take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. They don't take an oath to the country per se or the people in it. They take it to the Constitution. So, and the Constitution giveth and taketh away from both parties. So It's fine. Go ahead, read.
Yeah, are they reading the whole thing, all the amendments?
Yes, I believe so.
Wow.
I think they get in severe trouble. The Republicans would if they just read the Constitution without the amendments, because there's, you know, things such as the free speech and freedom of religion and minority rights and so forth that were extended by the Bill of Rights and the other amendments. So I think they've got to read the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. What kind of branding do the Democrats have? You write that they're trying to figure out who or what they are. There has been a lot of concern, particularly among progressive Democrats, to figure out who this president is, what kind of president. Do they have a branding, or is it, well, let's agree with the Republicans on some things and listen to them? And what are they fighting for?
Well, that's a very good question. That's the point that I raised in the piece that I did for the Huffington Post. I think that it's interesting that we're having this discussion today, because the president is in the process of deciding who else is going to advise him in the second half of his first term here. And I think if he picks Gene Sperling to be the head of the economic team, which it looks like he's going to do, and if he picks Bill Daley of Chicago to become his new chief of staff, which could well happen, then I think the president will have completed his transition from outsider to insider and from sort of progressive crusader to survivalist, and mere survival does not a brand make.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the concern that I raised. And I think the Democrats do have certain core values in terms of the role of government, in terms of saying that, hey, government has a role here, and health care is an example of it. But I think what the Democrats will be defined by in the next couple of years is sort of a negative thing, in the sense that they try to protect certain programs and policies of the last many years.
You describe this Obama-McConnell tax bill. You know, you just say that and you say, whoa, what does that mean, the Obama-McConnell tax bill?
Yeah, all right. And I think that's a big question, because that was a Republican bill, and there was a lot of sort of commentary afterwards that the president, you know, had somehow gained some power and momentum from cutting that deal. But that was essentially a Republican deal. Now, what the Democrats claimed was that they got unemployment, an extension of unemployment insurance out of it. But, you know, that used to be something that was kind of nonpartisan, the extension of unemployment insurance. It really wasn't a partisan matter. So for the president to say, hey, I got something great out of those negotiations, was a little lame, I think.
Yeah. And do the Republicans have a pretty solid brand, Howard?
Well, I think so. And I think the Tea Party was all about emphasizing it. And as I said in the piece, they focus on the role of markets, on the role of the free enterprise system, so-called. They say they're for limited government and for cutting spending and reducing deficits and debt, although, as I also say in the piece, they claim they're for that, they support that, but are often fall short of following through on their own pledges. But at least that's their theory, and they're sticking to it. And in terms of business regulation, as I said, you know, as was just shown the other day when the new incoming head of the Government Operations Committee, Daryl Issa, the Republican from California, basically asked the business community, okay, what rules do you want us to change here? You know, how do you want us to change things?
Mm-hmm.
Those are Republicans, and that's been the Republican brand almost since the beginning.
You, today there's a post on Huffington Post from you. If you think the GOP's 2010 campaign talking point about slicing $100 billion out of the federal budget seems like a moving target, you aren't alone. Yesterday you said on Keith Olbermann, I was literally chasing that number, and I'll bet you were all around the Hill yesterday.
Yeah, and that's a perfect example of the Republicans having a clear brand in terms of rhetoric, but not following through on it in action. In the campaign, in the last campaign, they went around the country saying that they, if they got power, they were going to immediately cut $100 billion from the federal budget. Well, it turns out there was a lot of fine print in that. First of all, there is no such thing as the federal budget per se, at least in the next year. It depends on what decisions are actually made. And, of course, the president's budget was never enacted, and the Democrats never passed a budget plan per se. So it turns out, if you listen to Republicans now, they're saying, well, what we meant was we're going to cut $100 billion from the president's budget and the Democrats' budget numbers. But those numbers were never fixed, and the numbers were actually larger than what the actual budget this year is. So the $100 billion sounded would have been easier to accomplish had the numbers been bigger, which they're not. So that's one factor. The next factor is that since there was no real budget, what the Congress has done is extended last year's budget on into this year. And that is a lower number, which means that the Republicans would have a smaller target to cut from. And in addition to that, they've now extended last year's budget all the way into early March. And since the fiscal year, I hope our listeners are still with us, but you have to follow this like a three-card Monty game at Times Square. The fiscal year starts on October 1st, so October, November, December, January, February, and March. We're going to be almost halfway through the spending year when the Republicans get a crack at doing the cutting they claimed they were going to do. And, of course, now they're saying, well, wait a minute, the year's going to be half over, so we can't really cut 100, and the number is smaller than we thought it was originally. So, you know, when I finally got to somebody who knew what they were talking about over on the Senate side, they said that in the end, the Republicans would be able to cut no more than about $30 billion out of this year's budget. So they went from $100 billion in the campaign to $30 billion in real life.
Hmm. Howard Fineman is with us the first half hour of this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls. Call in early because he's with us for a half hour, and then we will talk with a Republican about the Republican brand. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, should you care to use that, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Can you tell me why you think, we have Robert Reich on, who I think is a pretty deep thinker,
yes,
a progressive certainly, and I read his book yesterday, and he talked a lot about forgetting our history in this country, that we have forgotten what it means to be concerned about the welfare of all Americans and the concentration of money in the very wealthy in this country and the middle class not being able to do very much, which is of deep concern to him. And that used to be something that certainly the New Deal would address and that Democrats used to address to make sure that everybody got a pretty good deal in this country. Why does this administration seem to be trying to placate, some would think, the party that is in opposition to them?
Well, the long and the short of it is money. I would trace a lot of the changes in dilution of the Democratic brand to the 90s and to the money chase symbolized by the search for soft money that the Clinton people engineered.
Mm-hmm.
It helped get Bill Clinton reelected, but Bill Clinton's the ultimate survivalist. Bill Clinton grew up in the South during the rise and came to power during the rise of Reagan Republicanism. And Bill Clinton learned how to swim against that tide, how to be a Democrat who could explain the virtues of government in calm tones, shall we say, in non-confrontational tones to a conservative majority in the country. And in doing so, Bill Clinton got himself elected and reelected and did some good things, for sure. But he also took the Democrats away from the tradition that you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's ironic that Robert Reich was in the Clinton cabinet. But Robert Reich was a progressive member of the Clinton cabinet. But that Bill Clinton took them away from the New Deal, Fair Deal, Great Society roots of Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, and Lyndon Johnson. And I suppose that Barack Obama would argue that by spending a year on passing health care reform, for which he was heavily criticized by a lot of the white wise guys inside the Beltway, including me, that he was honoring that tradition, that he was honoring the New Deal, Fair Deal, Great Society tradition by extending health care to people who didn't have it, by trying to reform the system and so forth. And I think you can make that argument, except that he stopped short of doing the thing that would have been attempted, at least, in the New Deal, the Fair Deal, or the Great Society, which is to have a public option, which is to extend Medicare, essentially, to everybody. And that's why the progressives are down. One of the reasons why the progressives are down on Barack Obama, on President Obama, because they don't view the health care reform as much reform as Obama did. Now, the ironic thing now is, as the Republicans attack the health care plan, as they try to dismantle it, as they try to take apart what they call Obamacare, I think some progressives are going to end up honoring the president more for having done it in the first place, if only because the Republicans are now trying to take it away.
Wendell Potter with us last week said, give the new members of the House 1 week and all the health insurance lobbyists will be meeting with them pretty much nonstop. They may pass a little something with repeal, but when it comes right down to it, the healthcare industry wrote a lot of that bill.
Oh, right, exactly. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. But my point is that the more the Republicans attack it, the more that helps Barack Obama convince progressives that it was worth doing in the first place. I mean, politics is a game of comparison, and when your enemies are attacking you, then you defend your leader.
Howard Fineman, our guest. Let's go to phone calls. Our lines are filled. Craig in Onalaska. Hi. Craig, are you there? No, Craig is gone. Dave from Wanakee. Hi.
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 I wanted to point out something that is sort of beyond branding. It's that there was a study that was released this week from the University of College of London, where they were studying brain structures and trying to find a correlation to people's political views. And they found that there's a segment of the brain called the amygdala, which is very deep in the brain, and it's related to emotions like fear, and it is thicker in conservatives, whereas the anterior cingulates are thicker in liberals, and the anterior cingulates are related to decision-making and anticipation. So I think the branding of Republicans is spot on, because everything they do is to amp up fear, and I don't think you can doubt that. I think that's been shown time and again.
I haven't heard about that study. It's all in the brain, huh, Howard?
Well, I would say that I don't agree with it, because there are portions of both parties that focus on fear and resentment and so forth, and there are some parts of conservatism that are optimistic. That was the great feat. Some would call it a trick. Some would call it a feat. Some would call it historic, of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan managed to put the sunshine in conservatism by selling it as an optimistic, future oriented return to the past. If that isn't, if that's a paradox, but that's what he sold. So I wouldn't entirely agree with that. And having covered Ronald Reagan and having seen him on the campaign trail and having seen him interact with voters in events, so I was looking at the emotions of the crowd, okay, to honor the caller's question. I don't think what Ronald Reagan evoked on the campaign trail was fear. I think he invoked a sense of community and optimism among conservatives, and that's why he's revered by them.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Dave, for the call. Craig from Onalaska, hi.
Yeah, good morning. My comment is that I find that the Republicans stick together when they have something that they want to either approve or disapprove of, and they all use the same language. It's, for example, the health care is always a job-killing bill, and I'd like to see the Democrats get a little more unified in what they're saying. Every time they talk about the health care bill, they should use the term life-saving bill, and I think that makes a difference. When you use the same language over and over, people get used to it. When you use different language, like the Democrats do, it's diluted.
Well, that's a brilliant observation by the caller, and I think he's right. And I think the reason for it is that the Democrats, for better or worse, feel at home with language, and they feel that they have a right to use it the way they want to use it, because they're at home with it. Whereas, and this is an oversimplification, of course, Republicans, a lot of them tend to come from the business community. They don't feel politics, and the language of politics is their natural home. So they study it and work it like you would work an advertising campaign, because they don't feel at home in it, and they feel a need to control it. And the caller's absolutely right. That was true years ago when Newt Gingrich was selling the contract with America. That every bit of language in that thing was carefully studied by Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster. And you see the same kind of thing now with the language coming out of the House Republican leadership. And, the Senate Republicans are joining in. They read the same documents. And I think the caller's absolutely right. And the Democrats, for better or worse, are it's like herding cats with the Democrats in terms of language and policy.
Yeah. But you, as a wise man inside the Beltway, and those of us who cover politics, get sick of it when we hear the same phrases over and over and over, don't you?
Well, it's yes, but see, the Republicans aren't talking to the commentariat. In other words, they're not talking to the wise guys inside the Beltway like me. They're talking to people who take a more cursory interest in politics. And if advertising has shown anything, if the advertising business has shown anything, it's that repetition works.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it works with a casual consumer. So that's who they're talking to. And that's another difference that the caller sort of implicitly raised. The Democrats tend to talk to the media. They talk inside the Beltway. They're really good at talking to the insiders. They're not so good at talking to average people. And the Republicans study the techniques of that more systematically in many cases than the Democrats do.
Thanks, Craig. Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Techniques of communication and political fighting set aside, if you look at the Democrats that we elect to Congress, they take their money from the same lobbyists. They disregard their constituents. They essentially have put a wall around Washington and separated themselves from everyone else. What that has led to, and I think everything else that you have said, suggests to me that we have a single-party state with marginal differences of rhetoric on the fringes. And what bothers me more about the Democrats than anything else is that they have joined with the Republicans in becoming a party of perpetual war. They have joined with the Republicans in utter failure on the question of a global warming and what it portends for world world economies. And so anybody who reads people like Andrew Bacevich would understand that we are in a situation where nobody, including the Democrats in Congress, are paying serious attention to the most vital issues that face not just the United States, but the world.
Thank you, Richard. Howard.
Well, I, in certain respects, I couldn't agree more with the caller. And I think that's what I said when I talked about how the money chase had become so dominant with the Democratic Party in the 90s. And part of that is that unions, which had been a source of power for the Democrats, were declining. Big city machines, which had been a source of power for the Democrats, were declining. I mean, society was changing. Reagan was president, had been president. You know, there was a sort of conservative tide. And to some extent, the Democrats joined it. And I do think the caller's right. I do think that the chase for money in politics, and don't forget, Kathleen, in the last midterm election, $3 billion was spent on television advertising.
Isn't that something?
$3 billion on TV advertising. So what do you expect the Democrats to do? They're going to go chase the money to buy the TV ads to get reelected or get elected. And they are drawing from the same pool of people for the most part. And that there has to be a relationship between that money hunt and the fact that income maldistribution, you know, the maldistribution of income in America between the richest and everybody else has grown to levels not seen, you know, in nearly a century before, you know, just as the progressive movement was getting started a century ago. So there are serious structural problems in the way things work, and I don't think the Democrats have honored their own tradition in terms of confronting them. I think when Barack Obama ran for president on the theme of change, he implicitly, if not explicitly, said he was going to tackle that. And the way he raised his initial money on the Internet gave hope that he would engineer a way around the system that the caller was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, as the general election approached, Barack Obama got money from all the same fat cats that everybody else always has. And the money, amount of money that came from the Internet declined as a proportion of the total. And I dare say, even though he'll raise a lot of money on the Internet this next time around, he's going to rely even more so on those same big donors as everybody else does from the same class of sort of corporate America that the caller's talking
mm-hmm.
about.
So what are you chasing around today on the Hill?
Well, probably whether Bill Daley's going to be chief of staff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wrote a piece the other day about it, so I'm shifting back down to the White House today. And I do think if Daley is picked and if Gene Sperling is picked, that will show you that Barack Obama has made the final transition from outsider to insider and from ideologue to survivalist. Because Bill Daley, who I've known for many years and who's a very shrewd guy and a decent guy, but he's the guy who stands at the intersection of money and power and has since the 80s when he first worked raising money for Walter Mondale in the 1984 presidential campaign. So that would be very highly symbolic and important if that's what happens.
And you suspect it will?
Probably. The problem he's got, though, is a lot of Bill Daley's advisors. Bill Daley's a big-picture guy, and he has a team of people he's always drawn on for the details.
The problem is a lot of those people are in business, and some of them are lobbyists, and it's not clear whether they can come into the White House given the old rules, that, given the rules that Obama established when he came in about not letting lobbyists into the White House staff. So that very problem just emphasizes what we've been talking about right now.
Yeah, it does. Howard, it's always great to listen to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, Kathleen. Belated Happy New Year.
Thank you. To you as well. Howard Fineman, senior political editor of the Huffington Post for a long time. He was with Newsweek, and you also see him on MSNBC. He's also a political analyst for NBC. We switch perspectives now and talk about the Republican brand, what it is. Ramesh Panuru, senior editor of National Review, is joining us in a moment, author of The Party of Death, The Democrats, The Media, The Courts, and The Disregard for Human Life. We should also tell you that Howard's book, he wanted us to mention, is The 13 American Arguments, Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This half hour of the program, Ramesh Panuru, we're spending the hour talking about what the Republican brand is, what the Democratic brand is. Ramesh is senior editor of National Review and author of The Party of Death, The Democrats, The Media, The Courts, and The Disregard for Human Life. We'll still be welcoming phone calls. Our lines are open right now for Ramesh. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Ramesh Panuru, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be on.
We were talking with Howard Fineman about what the Democratic brand is, and we couldn't quite figure out what it was. Do you think that the Republicans have a definite brand?
Well, I think that people generally associate the Republicans with more free market economics, tax cuts, smaller government, traditionalist social positions, and a more nationalist and aggressive foreign policy. People may be skeptical of how much they really adhere to those principles, but I think that there's a general sense on the part of the public that that's where the Republicans stand.
Mm-hmm. We talked quite a bit about the use of language and the use of slogans among Republicans and Democrats, and I think the feeling of the audience and our guests last half hour was that the Republicans are much better at this. Is it a conscious decision to use language in a certain way to be concise?
Well, all politicians who hope to be successful pay attention to how they use words to communicate, to persuade people. I don't think it is true that one party is better than another. I think if you were looking at the scene in 2008, a lot of Republicans were wailing about, you know, why don't we have as great a communicator as Barack Obama?
Mm-hmm. The Republicans will start today by, and I don't know how long this will be going on. They're going to read the Constitution, but they want to be mindful of the Constitution and all the bills that they are deliberating now. That's an interesting idea, isn't it? Who decided to do that, and why? And what does it do to your deliberations if you start them by reading the Constitution?
Well, you know, that is only one part of what they're doing. The other part, which I think is even more interesting, actually, is that Republicans want legislation to cite the constitutional provision on which it's based. And I think that does change the debate a little bit in Congress and gives it a more constitutional dimension. That is, you're not only going to be arguing about, is this bill a good idea or a bad idea based on its effects? But do we as a Congress, as a government, have the authority to get involved in this in the first place? Does the Constitution give us that power?
But then you could have endless debates on the meaning of the Constitution, couldn't you?
Well, you know, you could have endless debates on any topic that you're authorized to have debates about. And sometimes it does seem as though Capitol Hill is designed to do exactly that, endless debate. But I think it's a good thing that the consideration of any bill consider the Constitution as well as all the other things that that legislators rightly consider. There is, I think, too much of a tendency for legislators to say, oh, well, the courts will sort that out. But, you know, lawmakers take the oath to preserve and defend the Constitution, and that has to mean taking care that you're not passing unconstitutional laws.
Mm. Do you think that we have done that in the recent past?
Oh, I think absolutely. You know, of course, there are differing views of what the Constitution means and requires, but I think it is very hard to look at something like the health care legislation passed last year as consistent with the founders' design for constitutional government.
The health care bill will be discussed once again. There are some who are saying enough already. We've already discussed this endlessly over the last year, and it did pass. We don't want to hear discussion again.
Well, you know, depending on the polls you look at, either something like half the country or a majority of the country wants the bill to be repealed, which means that while it's certainly true that there are people who don't want this discussed anymore, I think that is by no means clearly the majority view of Americans.
Mm-hmm. And also the common wisdom is that it's not going anywhere in the Senate, and certainly the president would veto this. So why have the discussion?
You know, I think it's really sort of amazing that line of criticism has achieved such widespread currency. Just think back a couple of years when you had a Democratic Congress facing off against President Bush. Nobody, I think, sensibly so told Nancy Pelosi, don't push for stem cell funding. Bush is just going to veto it. Don't push for the S-CHIP program for health insurance for poor kids and middle-class kids, because Bush is just going to veto it. Everybody understood that you're building the case for the legislation you want to see, and some of it's going to take several years, and it's going to take a new president. And I think that's exactly what's going on here with the health care legislation. Republicans are building the case and setting themselves up for achieving the reform they think is desperately needed under a new president.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the Democratic branding and the Republican branding. If you were to say this is what Democrats are in 2011, this is what this president is in 2011, how would you describe the Democrats?
I would say it is a party that takes progressive positions on moral issues, that is more cautious about overseas interventions and more eager to wind down the ones we have, and that is more willing to use government activism in domestic economic matters. You know, again, there's what that means on particular issues, like what are you going to do about the auto companies. That's something that's going to be a much more specific, fine-grained answer. But I think at the, you know, sort of 10,000 miles up view, that's a reasonable description of where the Democrats are.
Would it be reasonable to say both of the parties are quite beholden to special interests, to big money, to lobbyists?
Well, it is certainly true that there are interest groups in both parties. You know, those interest groups tend to represent millions and millions of Americans, right? I mean, Republicans will always say, oh, the Democrats, they represent big labor. And the Democrats will say, well, big labor represents millions of American workers. And similarly, the Democrats will say, oh, it's just big business. On the Republican side, and Republicans will say, well, yeah, but, you know, those are businesses that employ a huge number of Americans, and they're really important for our economy. So the trouble with saying that they're beholden to special interests is, you know, what counts as a special interest is sort of in the eye of the beholder.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls for you. Our phone number for you to join this conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Ramesh Panuru is our guest, senior editor of National Review, author of The Party of Death, The Democrats, the Media, the Courts, and the Disregard for Human Life. We're talking this hour about what it means to be a Republican, what it means to be a Democrat. Are there issues that if you don't agree on certain issues, you're out of the party? We will talk about that a little bit more as we progress here. First call is Don from West Salem. Hello, Don.
Good day to you.
Hi. Go right ahead, Don.
Yes. My big question is with politics, when you have the news, all their facts have to be checked out, have to be confirmed. They have to be known to be true before they can say it. If they say a fact was a year ago, some news anchor got into trouble for stating something, and it turned out to be completely wrong, and he almost lost his job, or he lost his job. But it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
How come politicians get to put out all these ads that are blatantly lies, that are only there to scare people? How come those facts don't have to be checked?
Ramesh Panuru?
Well, I think the reason is that we have free speech in this country, and sometimes that means things that I don't think are true are going to be on the airwaves. Now, I have the right to write a letter to the editor or to write something in my column in National Review saying it's not true, and then somebody else has a right to come back and defend it. And I think that's just, sort of an inescapable part of having a freewheeling, robust, democratic debate.
Thanks very much for the call. Susan in Sauk City, hi.
Hi. I think you either have blinders on or maybe somebody paid you to write a book, because it's really clear. I'm not a kid. I'm 59 years old, and it's real clear to me that the Republican Party increasingly is a party of big business and total disregard for human life. Republicans consistently vote against bills that will help women and children. They oppose health care. It doesn't matter that so many people have lost their health care because they've lost their jobs, and we don't have a public option, but Republicans keep voting against these things. I'm really dismayed and discouraged by what the Republican Party seems to stand for. What it seems to stand for is increasingly embracing an ultra-right interpretation of government and of the Constitution.
And what about the Democrats? Are you happy with the Democrats, Susan?
No, I'm not very happy with them either, but I think a lot of people are very frightened right now, and I think a lot of people are just trying to survive. We don't know what we can do to have impact on this system anymore. Writing a letter to your legislators sure doesn't seem to do it. Getting involved in political campaigns, that doesn't seem to do it either, because we're up against corporate bucks.
Ramesh.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a ton of stuff for me to respond to in there. The opening comment that somebody paid me to write a book, yes, it is true. Most people write books in expectation of getting some sort of financial payment.
Right. What about her characterization of the Republicans being against the little guy, the party of big money, et cetera? Do you think both parties are parties of big money right now, that you can say that Republicans are more business friendly than Democrats?
Let me just make two points on that. First of all, the caller mentioned the public option. Like, it wasn't Republicans who destroyed the public option. It was Democrats in the House and the Senate who ditched that, and in President Obama didn't really fight for it. So, if the problem, if she's got a problem with that, she should be directing that toward the Democrats, it seems to me. Second, look, the U.S. has been long tied for the last decade and a half, having one of the top corporate tax rates in the industrialized world. With Japan's tax cuts going into effect, we are going to have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. So, no, it doesn't seem to me that big business is calling all the shots here.
Thanks, Susan. Linda from Norwalk. Our number, by the way, a couple lines are open, 800-486-8655. Hi, Linda.
Good morning. Quick, true story. Many years ago, I asked my mom when I was 12 years old, am I Republican or Democrat? She said, do you have 100 grand in the bank? I said, no. 10 grand? No. 1,000? No. Then you're a Democrat.
Mm.
Yeah, well, that's a funny comment. It is interesting, though, in the last couple decades, Republicans have gotten made more and more inroads among people who make less money, and Democrats have been really sort of evening the score among people who make more money.
What does the election of a number of Tea Party members in the freshman class of Congress, what does that do to maybe change the definition of what it means to be Republican, or what does it do to change the Republicans' focus on certain issues?
Well, I think that it is part of a turn on the Republican side towards really wanting to focus on cutting government spending and really being concerned about that set of issues. And so I think one of the things you're going to see this spring is some fights in the Congress where the Republicans are going to be trying to cut the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Which really wasn't something that was at all part of Bush-era Republicanism, which was not concerned so much about spending restraint, and as a result, spending increased quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Were you upset about that?
I thought it was unwise. I thought at the time, and still think, that the federal government spends too much.
Well, when you look at the budget, that's the problem, isn't it? That everybody wants to keep programs because they benefit people back home. Do you think that there is, we were talking with Howard Fineman about this, that the idea was to cut $100 billion as he was running around the halls of Congress yesterday. The most that they could come up with was $30 billion in spending cuts. And if you went beyond that, it would be trouble for America.
Well, it's going to be hard. The original Republican plan was to get back to 2008's spending levels by defeating the omnibus bill even in the lame duck session, that is before Republicans took the House. They made part of their goal. But getting the rest of the way, as Howard Fineman noted, is going to be difficult, because while people are against spending in the abstract, when you talk about particular spending programs, there are always groups of voters who find that spending really important. And even voters as a whole, right? If you're talking about Social Security or Medicare, two of the biggest items in the budget, most voters don't want any cuts there.
Right. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this half hour is Ramesh Panuru, senior editor of National Review, author of The Party of Death, The Democrats, The Media, The Courts, and The Disregard for Human Life. We're talking about what it means to be a Republican this half hour, what it means to be a Democrat. We talked about with Howard Fineman the first half hour. And the next hour of the program, Robert Reich will be joining us. He is the former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration and author. He's written a number of books, and we've talked with him about several of them. The latest is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John from Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, John.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that Barack Obama took more money from Wall Street than any other candidate in history. So, when our candidates are being funded by, these big businesses and things, how can anything really get done?
Ramesh?
Well, that is true. President Obama did take a lot of Wall Street money. But I guess there's a couple things. First of all, a lot of that Wall Street money went for Bush in 2004, and a lot of it was reoriented toward the Republicans more recently. So I think a lot of it ends up being backing the guy you think is going to be the winner, you're sort of currying favor again, as opposed to, you're getting behind the parade, not leading it. And I'll note that, financial reform that, obviously has its flaws, did pass Congress, notwithstanding all that Wall Street money.
Do you think, though, there's something fundamentally unfair about that, that it keeps the regular Jack and Jill in middle America and elsewhere from being able to have a strong voice?
You know, you can have the best funded candidate in the world, and if Jack and Jill voter doesn't like that candidate, they're not getting elected. You know, we've seen that again and again with candidates who've spent lots and lots of money and just haven't gone anywhere. The most famous example probably being John Connolly trying to buy the Republican nomination for president in 1980 and ending up getting one delegate to the convention. You've had famous megabucks candidates like Michael Huffington flame out in California. So I think we often exaggerate the power of money and underestimate the power of public opinion.
Wayne and Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Wayne.
Good to talk to you. Ramesh, I'd like to ask you a question. I consider myself a member of the Tea Party movement, and we've been referenced as rich fat cats and the upper crust, and I think Kathleen had a guest on that used those kind of phrases in describing us. I found so many people to be just average, run-of-the-Joe folks like I am that are in the Tea Party movement. We farmed for many years, and so we're not rich people, yet we joined this movement because we didn't like the direction the country is going. What are your thoughts about who are the people that make up the Tea Party movement? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Wayne.
So wait, I'm supposed to talk to him off the air?
I'm sorry?
Did he said he wanted me to talk to him off the air?
Oh, no, no, no. He
okay.
He wants to, he'll
right.
listen to you off air. I mean, on air, off
Well, you know, if you
the
if
phone.
You do detailed survey research on the Tea Partiers, you basically get a picture of people who are conservatives, but who are not partisan Republicans. And you get the exact demographic mix you'd expect that. So more white than the national average, a little older than the national average, a little more affluent than the national average, but these are just matters of degree. There are plenty of people making $30,000, $40,000 a year who are Tea Partiers. You've got the basically same mix, suburban, urban, rural, of your voters at large. I mean, so basically I think that the answer is Tea Partiers are very conservative, usually Republican, but not all that partisan Republican. That is, they're not so much attached to the party name as they are to their conservative views.
Bob in Kenosha, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good, nice to talk to you, Kathleen. I just have a comment, and I'd like to both comment on my comment. I feel like right now in politics, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, the most important thing that we can do as a country is get rid of special interest groups. To me, it's step one. As I've been listening, I have the analogy I thought of. We're trying to clean up the Gulf spill of politics without stopping the spill. There is no particular vote that can go without special parties influencing it from the for-profit colleges to health care to anything else. And both parties are to blame. Special interests help certain groups for this or that. The Supreme Court at the very highest just allowed 2 years ago big business to have unlimited money now secretly. It's kind of like letting the mafia run the country. We're allowing it in the open. It may happen under the covers in the future if we put a stop to this, but the first step is at least stop it, make it illegal. And I think if we can do that, we can start having these politicians do what's right for the country instead of what's best for them, their pocketbook, and getting reelected. What do you think about that?
I think, you know, getting rid of the special interests is impossible in a free and democratic society. You know, if you go back to the Federalist Papers, you know, Madison talks about faction and the spirit of faction, and he doesn't argue we should do what we can to eliminate it. He says we need to design a system that can work and can harness the competitive energies of factions to serve the greater good. And I think that is what we ought to be doing. That is, you know, the solution to our problems is not going to be trying to get rid of the factions, but trying to figure out a way, again, to harness them as the founders, I think, pretty brilliantly did.
Well, I'm not trying to actually get rid of them. What I'm trying to do is prevent them from giving money to candidates. That's the issue that makes them want to vote a certain way, which may be against the interest of the people.
Well, corporations, you know, can't, in fact, donate to candidates. What they can do, and what the Supreme Court said that they could do, is pay for advertising on political issues, including during election seasons. Seems to me that's a pretty clearly correct view, and something, again, that you can't really stop if you're going to stay a free society.
Well, I appreciate your point. I do disagree. I think with the internet and the availability of open communication, and that if we could stop that, that money does a lot to decide where votes go. And I just think that peppers most of the views, unfortunately.
Thank you, Bob, for your thoughtful call. We're out of time for this hour. Ramesh Panuru, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be on.
Yeah, I would love to have you on again. Ramesh Panuru is senior editor of National Review, and he is the author of The Party of Death, The Democrats, The Media, The Courts, and The Disregard for Human Life. Howard Fineman with us before, a senior political editor for The Huffington Post and author of The 13 American Arguments, Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country. Thanks to Chrissy Peace for producing this interesting program, and to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio. Robert Reich will join us the next hour of the program. Always a wonderful guy to listen to, so stay with us on the Ideas Network.